All right. I guess it's 9 o'clock already, isn't it? Oh, or 10 o'clock, whatever the hell it is. All right. We just did the protagonist. This is the antagonist. How to write effective villains, arch enemies, and assorted nemesis. And I guess we will start with some introductions. Coming from the right, please.
Hi, I'm Mark Tassin. I have written a number of short stories. I've worked on a novel for Shadowrun, done a fair amount of game writing now for Shadowrun and some other games. Written for MMORPGs. I've done some editing. I'm also on the This Pens for Hire session for a reason. I'm very mercenary. If you'll pay me, I will write anything you like.
So. I'm Brad Bollier. I write science fiction and fantasy in short form. Just a few of the anthologies I've been in, and I'm also in the Stalking the Hare. Well, I couldn't remember that. The Stalking the Hare anthology. Stalking the Wild Hare. I have a reading coming up at noon, if anybody's interested. I'm working with Paul Jeunesse and Kelly Swales are going to help me with it, and then I have a signing later on today. And I have a fantasy, epic fantasy trilogy coming out with Nightshade Books next year.
Yay. Yep. What's it called? Yeah.
The first book, I don't have a series name yet, but it's The Winds of Kalakovo is the first one, and it's Song of Ice and Fire meets Earthsea. That's my elevator pitch.
Oh, very cool. My name is Gregory Wilson. I am an associate professor of English at St. John's University. That's my day job, where I teach courses in fantasy fiction and creative writing, among others. I'm also increasingly an author. My first book, which is called The Third Sign, came out last year from Gale Cengage, which is a work of epic fantasy. That was actually just within the last month optioned for a film, which is cool. I have a second book, which is being looked at by major publishers now that my agent submitted, called Icarus, which is a very different kind of fantasy, and I'm working on a third. I also am co-editing a anthology of speculative fiction and politics short stories with people like Joe Haldeman and stuff like that, and Paul, actually, and some other people are in this anthology from the Writer's Symposium as well. And since people mentioned this, and I forgot to mention this panel, I'm also doing a reading tonight with Chris Pearson at 7 o'clock, no, at 5 o'clock, I believe, and you can find it in your book. I don't remember exactly the time. And also we'll be doing a signing later on either today or tomorrow. I can't remember. And so if you want to find me again besides on these panels, that's where you can do it.
I'm Richard Lee Byers. I write fantasy and horror. I have done a, a string of Forgotten Realms novels in recent years that some of you may have seen. I recently wrote an urban fantasy, which is being shopped around, and wrote a comic book miniseries on spec, which an artist friend of mine is drawing, and then we'll be submitting when he's got an issue done as a sample. So I've done this, that, and the other. My most recent book is The Captive Flame, which I think is probably not in the dealer's room, but if you schlepped over to the bookstore a couple streets over, you might find it. Anyway, this is about, this is the panel on how to write an effective protagonist and...
Antagonist.
And antagonist.
We just did protagonist.
We just did, right, whatever. All right, and maybe we should start with kind of a definition. When you talk about the antagonist in a story, what do we mean? What is that?
Sure. When I think about an antagonist, some of this came up a little bit in the last panel. What I think about usually is either an environment or a character or, to be very vague, a force which is operating against the interests of the protagonist or groups of protagonists within the story. That does not, we made this point last panel, it's important to make in this one, that does not define either protagonist or antagonist as good and evil, which is often how it's done, and that's not necessarily the case. It can often be the case that the protagonist is not really such a good person and the antagonist is actually working against them in the name of, you know, objectively good, whatever that means, right? So really what it is the forces that are arrayed against and actively working against the main character in completing his or her goals. And I think what elevates the antagonist above the level of just a simple obstacle, like we've got to get over this mountain or something like that, is that it becomes the defining thing against which the protagonist must measure him or herself. It is that particular thing that must be, or things, which must be conquered in some way. That can sometimes even be some kind of, you know, sometimes internalized flaws can operate this way, but usually it's some kind of external agent. Sometimes it can be the stereotypical villain working against the hero. In other cases, it can be an incredibly unforgiving environment, and you need to somehow survive that unforgiving environment. And sometimes there will be several antagonists that shift. We used the Lord of the Rings example before. There you have Sauron, who is the ultimate antagonist, but you also have other sort of more limited antagonists that are certainly more than obstacles. Even getting through Mordor to Mount Doom, right? Mordor itself operates as an antagonist for them because it is such an unforgiving environment that is so difficult to traverse. And obviously other characters, like Gollum, for example, is a significant antagonist for them, in part. And so antagonists, I think, are the forces that are arrayed against the protagonist in accomplishing whatever it is those protagonists want to do, but it's more than just little sort of minor speed bumps. They are significant major obstacles on which the protagonist must devote a lot of time, I would say.
Yeah, I think I'll start by repeating something I said last panel, and sorry for those who've heard it. But I think it's important to keep this in mind, too, with antagonists. And Greg touched on it a little bit already. I'll recommend Orson Scott Card's Characters and Viewpoint. And it has a quotient, he calls it. It's a mice quotient. He's talking about the four types of stories. There's M-I-C-E. So there's a milieu story, which is like, it could be Call of the Wild, would be one, Larry Niven's Ringworld, where the antagonists are really going through a world, seeing different things, and even Lord of the Rings. And the antagonist is the world, right? And then there's an idea story, which is largely mysteries fall into this category. Something happens in the beginning, a dead body is found, and the whole story is really revolving around finding out what happened. C is the character story. A character is at some point in their life where they want to change something about themselves. And the story is about them overcoming that change, making that change. And then the E is an event story, which is typically something like Lord of the Rings, where there's an event on the horizon, it's coming, and the heroes have to rise up to stop it. And so the antagonist is not always a character. It can be society. It can be the character's self that's keeping them from achieving what they want to achieve. So kind of keep that in mind as we're kind of talking about these stories, and I think that's important as you're trying to kind of formulate stories as well to think about this early on.
I think that what Brad's saying really illustrates one of my thoughts about this is that in real life we all face antagonists, but they are, although you might believe differently, I personally believe that most of these antagonists are effectively random. They aren't placed in our way for any specific reason, and the way that we grow after encountering these antagonists is in itself not predestined. With your writing, these antagonists are there for a reason. They are there to help the character to develop in a certain way. And simply having an antagonist for the sake of the antagonist, because, you know, stories have challenge, to me is never quite enough. I like there to be something more there, a sort of a plan on, yes, this type of challenge will help the character grow in this way, which will show this development by the end of the tale. And so I think that's an important distinction between real-life antagonists and literary antagonists.
In the case of my life, I feel like they really are all out to get me. but maybe that's just me. One way of looking at Lord of the Rings is on one level, yeah, it's certainly a story with multiple antagonists, you know, multiple challenges. But on another level, you can look at that story and saying that all the various problems reflect the same underlying corruption, you know, whether it's Sauron or an orc, or the desolation of Mordor that the characters have to schlep through and survive, or the psychological stress of bearing the ring, yeah. You know, that it's only all kind of manifestation of the same thing. If you're writing that kind of story where you are going to, on the one level, have multiple antagonists, do you think that it's important to have that sort of underlying unity?
You win for bringing that out. I've never thought of it that way for Lord of the Rings. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And I think that for me, that to me is good writing to me. Because what you end up doing is you create a scenario that consciously you're not really perceiving the connection between these different things. But at the end of the day, the different challenges they face do all tie back to this single idea. And to me, that sort of a tight structure is really beautiful, and the reader recognizes it subconsciously.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a great thing.
In part, I think, because it plays off of the most significant fears, doubts, flaws, as we talked about last panel, of the protagonist in this case, because each of those things you mentioned in some ways ties into this deep concern about whether the character will be ready when the time comes, whether the character is really suited, really worthy, you know, if you think about a character like Frodo, whether they're worthy for facing an antagonist like, you know, Sauron, Mordor, the Ring itself. I mean, the Ring is very much personified as an antagonist within that story. And even the movies pick up on this, where the Ring has its own presence and resonance. And I remember reading, watching some of the behind-the-scenes stuff where Peter Jackson talked about having to figure out, there's that one scene in the very first, in The Fellowship of the Ring, where Bilbo drops the ring on the ground, and there's this sound like a weight had fallen, far more than a normal ring would be. That's trying to give it a certain presence, because there is a malevolent identity about it, right? It's not just this physical thing. And so, to the degree that all of these things, worthiness, not big enough, not strong enough, not powerful enough, not right enough, not good enough to do these things, all of those fears kind of surround our character, and each one of these antagonists, in that sense, kind of plays or directs itself at that fear. And so I think that makes that, really interesting.
I think it's difficult to get away from pulling in some of those elements into a story that might be mostly about milieu or mostly a mystery. And in fact, I think that's why it's important to think about these things, because as an example, you might have a story where your setting is very static. One of the ways that you can increase reader satisfaction is by putting the characters in interesting places, right? So you're starting to take on some of the, not so much travelogue, but you're starting to show your world a little bit more. If you think about Sex and the City, right? It's mostly character stories, right? They're trying to kind of make their way through their lives and find love, but it's very much about New York too, right? It's very much a milieu story as well. So that being said, Richard brought up a really good point that I'll reiterate here. While I think it's very important to look into these things, and even I would urge people to write a flash piece on one of each type of the different types of stories. Just so you can kind of grok it, right? It's also important to eventually forget about that stuff. It will soak in. When you think about any given story, one of those elements will kind of pop out. Like Lord of the Rings, you think of the ring into the Mount Doom, right? You don't think of those other things first. And so eventually those things will kind of melt and merge, and you'll bring elements in without even thinking about it. So.
I think Carrie is the antagonist in Sex and the City. She just irritates me.
She's your antagonist.
Yeah, she's my antagonist.
I can't even explain how distressed I am that Sex and the City somehow ended up. I can't even. I just, the mind boggles. We are off the rails. One thing I wanted to point out that I was thinking about as you were all talking about this was that the good thing about writing an antagonist, and what's sometimes more difficult than writing the protagonist than the antagonist, is that the antagonist fundamentally is disrupting, right, the order that the protagonist is used to. Now, that can often be an order built out of chaos. If you have a protagonist who's a pirate and loves nothing more than traveling the seven seas and, every day is a new adventure, I mean, that is the sort of established order. In that case, antagonist, there have been several books written about this, the antagonist can be, someone whose job is to try to get that pirate off the ship and kidnap, or not, I shouldn't say kidnap, but either capture them if they're an enemy or rival pirate, or bring them to justice. Well, the whole reason, let's say, that Jack Sparrow is the protagonist, and we sort of root for Jack Sparrow, is they want to either hang him, or which is the ultimate stasis, by the way, or bring him to, throw him in prison and keep him imprisoned forever and essentially disrupt what he always knew as the life that he wanted to live. And so in that way, as a writer, it's a lot of fun to write people who disrupt things. It is a lot of fun to write creatures or characters or forces that are disruptive in some ways. And that is both a strength and a weakness of it. It is a strength because it's fun to do. The weakness is if you allow yourself to be too seduced by the antagonist, you can find yourself writing a story in which your protagonist becomes sort of like a paper doll cutout and everything becomes about the antagonist. And as Mark pointed out, it has to go the other way. The antagonist has to be defining your point of view characters, the characters that move the story forward. If the antagonist ultimately is so much more interesting than the protagonist that we forget all about them, then you haven't really written an antagonist. Their job is to sort of to resist, to get in the way of, to create a way for the protagonist to grow. Their job is not to replace them in your mind as being so much more interesting that you forget about the other ones. So interesting, fun to write antagonists. If you overdo it, then you've really sort of made them kind of not really the antagonist at all. So you have to try to balance that, I think.
Yeah. Although that does kind of, I mean, again, I've written a lot of horror fiction, and you know, I'm very interested in horror fiction. I mean, that's something that, you know, that's something that kind of works in at least in some horror, certainly in horror film. You know, a lot of times the creature, the antagonist, is very much the figure that everybody becomes interested in. It becomes kind of a viewpoint thing whether you say it's the antagonist or the protagonist. But it works as a story in terms of entertaining people.
The monster in some ways is the protagonist, and right. The character is trying to keep them from eating. He's trying to keep them from eating. You know, yeah, it's disrupting exactly. This monster's way of life.
Exactly, yeah.
And although we're seeing it from the point of view of the antagonist in this case, it almost is for some of these stories.
So. Well, the Phantom of the Opera. No. I mean, the main character is the bad guy. Yeah. And all the good people are the secondary characters that somehow you have to, you have to get through this story where, you know, you get through all the fear and the suspense and the grief.
Yeah.
Okay. But and then you get to the point where you're starting to feel bad for the bad guy, and then you got to deal with it. You know.
Right. And that's the important part too about, as we said a little bit while ago, not confusing, you know, hero with protagonist and, you know, bad guy sort of objectively claimed with the antagonist, that each of these characters in some ways can shift, and sometimes you'll find yourself being brought along with the point of view character, and this happens quite a lot in horror, of the guy, you know, walking along with the axe, and you see the camera kind of shifting and, you know, following along with him. Now maybe we don't identify with him and say, I wish I was the guy carrying the axe, and so I hope not, and if you are, I'm sure you won't admit it here. It's Jen Khan, yeah, I know. What am I saying? But the truth is that, you know, at the very least, you find their story interesting, and that's precisely why they take you to, you know, the camera view of that particular character. But I still think, though, that when you get done with these things, the most valuable, at least works, at least in fantasy and science fiction anyway, the most valuable books are the ones where you had really fascinating, really interesting characters that you remember as antagonists, but you also remember the ways that the protagonists were able to, in some ways, overcome or at least deal with them in some way. To use an example, in the book Foundation and Empire, Asimov has a character called the Mule, who is a character that can psychologically adjust people's opinions of them and their emotional state towards them just by, like, Asimov describes it almost like a switch. Like, they just go, ding, and you like them. You like this person. And you have no control over it. You can't do anything about it. And yet one of the things that's interesting about that book is while you remember the character of the Mule, you also remember that some of the protagonist characters came across and found out who it was, because you don't know at the beginning who the Mule actually is, found out who it was, and managed to in some ways interact with reason with the Mule such that the Mule chooses not to change the protagonist's emotional opinion of him, which he could very easily do. The fact that he doesn't do that is because the protagonist impacted him, because the protagonist reached him and caused him not to use the power that he would otherwise have used. And for much of the book, since you don't know who the Mule is, he's the antagonist. He's the looming force. He's the one that you don't know anything about. You're not in his head at all. And it's only at the very end that you find out about him, and you're like, wow, this guy's an amazing character, but it's even more amazing that the protagonist figured out a way to deal with this guy and not cause him to sort of essentially destroy everything about the universe, because he would have been able to just say, you like me, you like me, you like me, and everyone would have gone along with it. So so it's important to recognize, I think, that if you lose the protagonist in the pursuit of, oh, this antagonist is so cool, I think you've kind of missed the idea of having a balanced story. So.
What Asimov's story is that?
It's Foundation and Empire, I believe. It was the second book. So I think it's Foundation and Empire and Second Foundation, right? So Foundation and Empire. And that is, I think, also the best of the three, in my view, the best of that first three, partly because of that character.
One minor clarification is that just because we're saying the antagonist isn't the focus of the story, it doesn't mean it's not the focus of the lives of the people in this world.
Right.
Sauron's pretty darn important.
Has to be, yeah.
Middle-earth, you know? But that doesn't mean that he's going to take over your book.
Right.
So.
Yep.
Or Darth Vader.
Sauron never even makes it on stage. This is one of the interesting things about Lord of the Rings. He's characterized, as I mentioned, he's characterized by the fact that all the things that the characters do, all the bad things the characters do come face to face with are all essentially manifestations of who he is. They reflect one aspect of his being or another.
In fact, I think it's his absence that makes him even more interesting, because he's always there, but you never see him. And there's a point where you go, you know, and I would imagine you would say, Richard, if tell me if I'm wrong, that some of the best horror involves creatures that you don't necessarily see the boogeyman in the closet until maybe it's too late. And part of what sort of builds tension is, what is this thing? What you know, and you don't just reveal, you know, throw all your cards at the table early on. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, well, that's well, particularly if you're actually trying to write flat-out horror and create fear. I mean, a lot of people have said, you know, well once you... Once you really show it, you know, and tell all about it, then that, you know, that from that point, you know, it's no longer, or at least it's extremely difficult to generate the same level of fear thereafter, because, you know, once you reveal this, well, okay, then the reader can start coping with it, you know.
Yep.
I mean, there's a school of horror that says that you never really reveal it all. It's like Lovecraft stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. There's always. Yep. I mean, there's always, even when you glimpse an honest to God, you know, elder entity like Cthulhu, which you do in the story, the Call of Cthulhu, you do in fact kind of see him. You know, there's still levels of cosmic awfulness beyond that, and holding stuff back is a really valuable technique. I think we've you know kind of talked a lot about. You know, either explicitly or implicitly about you know what makes an effective antagonist. What are some of the pitfalls you can get into? What should you be thinking about? What should you be trying to avoid when you write an antagonist?
I think I had this discussion with my agent. You know, before I had that discussion, I would have said avoid completely black. Hats, you know, for the antagonist, and avoid completely white hats for the protagonist. You don't want them completely evil. Although Sauron is a perfect example of something that is very evil. It's pure evil, right? I prefer the George Martin style of writing, where things are pretty gray. You know, you can look at a character and really kind of hate them initially, but later on. He writes a viewpoint from that character, and you start to understand why they are the way they are. And so I like to have, both protagonists and antagonists, but a lot of times some writers may forget to do this on the antagonist side because they're not the viewpoint character. Give them human wants. You know, they're trying to achieve something as well, and make it not just believable, but sympathetic in a way. Sympathetic in the way that we see them in their world. We understand the life that they have lived. You know, maybe it's a cultural difference. It doesn't matter so much what it is, as long as within the context of their character, they're doing things for reasons that they believe in. And that makes, to me, a really compelling antagonist.
Yeah.
So to finish up that story, my agent said after reading my book was that he didn't think it would be a blockbuster because it wasn't so black and white. He said, you know, a lot of the ones that maybe cross over to kind of mainstream, really wide audiences, those types of things have a little bit more black and white on the heroes
Well, and I think that, you know, there's a danger, though. I mean, I guess this is part of what makes good writing, is knowing where to cross the line, knowing how much of this to put in. I mean, making Darth Vader a character who is a sympathetic character in some ways ruined the character for people.
Yeah.
There were a lot of people who were like, wait, he was just the bad guy. You know, it's sometimes it's okay when the bad guy's just bad. You know, so I think the important thing, again, is what it goes back to is balancing that, knowing what kind of a story you're writing, knowing what's going to work for your story. You put an unsympathetic bad guy into a story where shades of gray are appropriate and it's going to clash. It's just sort of learning what works in those situations. But at the same time, they still have motivations. I think that's important. I mean, Darth Vader clearly has goals. You know, Sauron has goals. Maybe they're just corrupt everyone and ruin the world. Those are goals, you know. And so he still has a motivation, something he's striving for, while the protagonist is striving to accomplish what he wants to accomplish.
I think that's a really important distinction to make, in that you can have characters which would be judged from the outside as objectively evil. But if you make them, as they look in the mirror when they wake up in the morning, I use this last panel too, if you make them the kinds of characters that you could imagine saying to themselves, well, evil me, who am I going to unjustifiably harm today? I mean, like, no one does this, yeah. You know? I mean, no one who has ever lived has been the kind of person who has gone out of their way to do nothing but evil without feeling that they had some justification, they had been wronged, or that life is chaos and they need to contribute to it. Nobody goes out unless they're sociopathic and not, you know, not with it. Some people are the majority of people out there have some kind of believable motivations for themselves and why they do what they do. That said, you can still have those motivations without removing the evilness from the outside. We do this all the time, right? People who are brought up on murder trials may say, well, they had it coming, Your Honor. I'm like, well, if you think they had it coming, okay. You know, yeah. We don't do that. We still judge them. We still make decisions about whether they are good or evil objectively, but that doesn't change the fact that they felt a particular way. You know, I'm reminded of the character of Iago, which I think I talked about last year here, in Othello. In the original version of the Othello story from which Shakespeare pulled his play, the reason Iago hates Othello so much is because Othello sleeps with his wife. This isn't implied, it's a fact. Othello slept with his wife, slept with Emilia, and Iago is understandably really pissed about it and chooses to get revenge on him. Well, the key thing Shakespeare does is he takes away that motivation from Iago. You say, why? We're supposed to know all about everything. Well, the reason he takes the motivation away is what a very famous literary critic called Stephen Greenblatt calls strategic opacity. It's a great term. Strategic opacity. It means that we don't really know exactly why Iago hates Othello as much as he does. We simply know that he does, and part of what makes him such a memorable antagonist for us is the fact that we remember him and think, that guy wouldn't even tell us why at the end. He says, I will never speak more, right at the end of the play, and you're like, what? How dare you not tell me why you did what he did? And of course, that makes him even more evil in your mind, right? The difference is that he's also believable as a character despite not telling you why he's doing what he's doing, because Shakespeare knew and built into the backstory, even if you don't see it explicitly, Shakespeare knew about this part that Othello slept with his wife in the original story. And so that informs what Iago is. It means that you imagine him as a believable character, even though he won't tell you what it is that makes him this way. And that, I think, is the important balance to strike. It means that you give them motivations, you give them passions, the same things that, you know, motivate all of us as human beings, but you don't have to then also say, and see, so therefore they're really not bad. No, they can still be bad, but their motivations are justified in their own head as to why they're bad in that sense.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's really valuable to remember that even the worst people in the real world don't self-identify as evil.
Yeah.
You know, almost without exception. People who do despicable things don't think, you know, I do these things because I serve evil. You know, I mean, and the other side of that coin is that it's not as rare, but I think the average good should not consciously be saying, you know, my thing in life is to serve the good.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think that the guys that went off and fought World War II were sure as hell serving the good, but I don't think most of them thought they were serving the good. They thought they were serving their country. Yeah, I mean,
Because they were fighting a group of people who felt exactly the same way on the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, the Germans thought that too.
Yeah. I think that's often a really good, you know, good thing to stay away from, the idea that, you know, certainly the human character that thinks of himself as, you know, the conscious servant of evil. I think that's a big trap. That said, though, you know, if you're writing fantasy or horror. You know, there is a trope that you can use that there are characters who are intrinsically aligned with the dark side, you know, demons or whatever. And depending on what you're writing, you know, it may work in your story to be pretty unequivocally to, you know, say, well, you know, maybe not any of the human characters, but, you know, this thing with four eyes and the barbed tail over in the corner, you know, it's bad because it's bad because it's bad. And, you know, readers normally aren't necessarily looking for, like, kinder, gentler, more comprehensible Cthulhu, you know?
But totally get where Cthulhu's coming from.
Oh, yeah. I totally had a bad childhood. But even... This is why the later movies that try to explain Hannibal Lecter are such a disaster, right? Yeah. It's kind of like, I don't want to know. But the only thing I'll say about that, though, is I think you're totally right about the, you know, demons are just demons to be demons, but even there, they might say, and I do some of this with some of the evil characters in my books, that they would even say that there is a reason that they serve the good, that they serve strength, and that, you know, strength does make a difference, and that if you don't have the strength to survive, it is survival of the fittest and all this stuff. I mean, again, these are goals which we as a modern society have, at least in an ideal sense, rejected, but that doesn't mean that they aren't sort of functional goals for them. Yeah. So unless you have to sort of, you know, sort of running after you, which zombies, I don't know, maybe, but unless if you have something with a real sort of conscious awareness about them, I think they have to have at least the sense that, you know, I'm at least serving the strong and might makes right and all that.
Yeah,
you know,
I did a novel about the Forgotten Realms Dark Elves, you know, called Dissolution, and you know those characters are you know explained as, well, you know, we worship a god of evil and we know we worship a god of evil, and you know, that's kind of your you know, you can't really not write that. And so, you know, the way life finesse, I mean, I had to accept that, but I tried to, you know, I finesse, well, what do they mean when they say evil? And what I is in my book, and my kind of, you know, they kind of mean social Darwinism. I mean, it was kind of like, why do you think there is a civilization? Why do you think there's, why do you think that good things happen? You know, it's because people are ambitious, because people are selfish, it's because people try to get to be the boss. They can only get to be the boss by doing things well, kind of. And so, yeah, I totally agree with you. I'm starting to see some. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say one thing. I think though that I'd like to point out is that just because these motivations are there doesn't mean you need to tell us all of them. I mean, I am a firm believer in the idea that if you create these ideas in advance, it will come through in your writing without you ever coming out and saying it.
Definitely,
people will recognize that there is more there. So. Good to have them, but you don't need to have the villain come out and explain about it.
That's the Iago thing,
right? We're starting to see some hands, so let's start taking some. This is the first hand I saw a moment ago. Didn't you have a hand up?
Yeah. As I said, I worked for a criminal defense lawyer, and he says two things about criminals. As soon as a criminal tries to explain why what they're doing is right, he says, that's the guy who really isn't the bad guy. The bad guys just know it. They've bought into whatever reasons they've bought into. But they don't try and explain it. It is, to them, okay, and that's just the way it is. It's the guys who want to be bad who try and explain it.
When you were talking about, like, antagonist point of view, it brings in my favorite villain has always been Dr. Doom. It's just a shame that we can't write stories about him, okay? Because he's such a complex character, and he really thinks that if he rules the world, it will be a better place.
Which,
you know, he goes Dr. to Doom hell every year to fight for the soul of his mother using magic.
Well, he finally busted her out.
Did he bust her out?
Yeah, there's a graphic novel where he enlists the help of Dr. Strange, and they bust her out.
You know, and I don't know how many times he's actually saved the world, okay?
Yeah.
So... But he's still Marvel's biggest villain, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing about Doom that makes him, Doom that kind of makes him more villainous again. I mean, it's like, he actually does believe that he's going to rule the world for the world's benefit. But they show you that that's kind of ultimately a cheat because you see his, you see the underlying kind of. vanity and pettiness in his competition with Reed Richards, you know, and his obsessive hatred of Reed Richards and things like that. I mean, he does have a certain grandeur to him, which is what makes him Marvel's great. But they balance that with a real underlying nastiness, and it works.
I mean, well, the thing is, though, is that if you make your antagonist too much, too understandable, then you're hero becomes this jerk, and you say, well, dude, he's just trying to save his mom.
Yeah.
You're a big jerk for beating him up, so you got to be careful of that.
Leave
Godzilla
alone so she can take care of her eggs.
And that, I think, yeah, I mean, that's the other thing about creating, when you were talking about, I lost it. Oh, yeah, I mean, one of the things that I find frustrating about the way in which we represent these characters and their sort of, you know, their sort of notions of evil and their understanding of evil and all these other sorts of things is that it becomes so sort of single-mindedly this idea that, well, evil has this ultimate power that it always wants to accomplish. When evil is done correctly or portrayed correctly in books, what you find out is that evil ultimately becomes petty. Evil is very, very petty. Even the most grand expressions of evil ultimately come down to petty concerns, right? They come down to satisfying some need you have in yourself without necessarily thinking about the needs of others. Even Dr. Doom, as you just said, you know, Dr. Doom wants to rule the world for the good of the world, you know, in some sort of grand sense, but he wants to be the one doing it, and he wants people, even when this happened, to acknowledge, oh, thank you so much, Dr. Doom, for ruling the world so that we can, you know, please, sir, may I have another, right? Like, I mean, that kind of sort of approach that all evil characters of this kind take is sort of puts the lie to the sort of good that would come out of evil. If you think about a character like Dr. Faustus in Marlowe's great play, which is also Goethe's Faust and that same character, right, who sells his soul to the devil. It's the classic selling your soul to the devil story. When he first does this, he has grand plans. He's going to circle Germany in a wall of brass, and he's going to, you know, make all the philosophers will be kings, and they'll all this and that. And by the time we get to the end of the play, he's, you know, making fun of the Pope and, you know, like literally throwing pies in the face of the cardinals, you know, and joking about it with Mephistopheles. I mean, so the idea is by the time you get to the end, you don't have this sense of, yes, evil. You go, ugh. And I think the reaction that we eventually have is this kind of repulsed, I can't believe you would do all of this damage just for that. So I think that's the important thing to keep in mind, is that in a lot of ways, ultimately, what the antagonist sort of represents when they're being evil, and again, not always are antagonists evil, but when they are being evil, that sort of grandeur sort of drops out of the picture as you go along, and you're left with a very petty person sort of going out for very little things. That's ultimately what evil does.
You can see in your hand for a while.
I guess I actually have two questions, but the first one really is that, can you have a character who behaves as both protagonist and antagonist? You have one character who's, say, defined as definitely the protagonist. And you have another character who is protagonist in the sense that, you know, there's this big, awful goal, like when Dr. Doom teams up with the Fantastic Four to essentially save the world. But in the character's internal struggles, your protagonist has something that they want to change about themselves or that they want to stay the same. And your other protagonist, someone, you know, who helped with the external goals, is in conflict with those internal goals. Is that something like what you would consider then a rival or...
Sure. I mean, that you know, so in that sense, protagonists and antagonists are in the eyes of the beholders. I mean, if you look at a guy, we've mentioned George R. R. Martin before, does this all the time, and, you know, will have a viewpoint character represent themselves in their viewpoint chapters, and then we'll move on to something else where someone else is going, you know, I hate blah that you were just reading about in viewpoint chapters for these reasons. Steven Erickson does this too. And so one of the things that comes out of that is it creates an environment for the reader where the reader then is never really sure where to put their allegiances. I want to make one sort of more subtle point about that, which is important, which is that although in the process of developing that sense that you never really know who to support, right? You never. Gabriel Garcia Marquez is another one who does this a lot in his novels. The one danger of that approach, the good thing is that it's in some ways it's more realistic, as you said. Shades of gray are what we encounter more in life, and so on. The one drawback to that is that people can eventually become uncomfortable with reading entirely if they never feel confident that, all right, at least now this person's doing something I think is the right thing. If you, and there are some authors who have trouble with this, they'll be like, well, no, but that actually wasn't the right, you know. And if you're constantly being shifted and yanked and jerked around from place to place, I as a reader, and I imagine most of you as readers, will eventually stop reading that kind of thing because you go, I need to have at some point have some belief that, okay, here what they're doing, maybe elsewhere they made a lot of mistakes, here they're doing what, you know, kind of objectively what they ought to do in this particular situation. So it's important in that sense if you're going to kind of change antagonists and protagonists, as you just mentioned in these stories. I think that's a very good thing. I think you have to be careful not to overuse it or it becomes something which is sort of deadening to the reader where they just stop caring altogether about these people because they don't want to get emotionally invested with them.
They did that in Black Sun Rising, which is the part of the first book in the Cold Fire trilogy. Mm-hmm. I haven't read the rest yet. I've just read the first one. Loved it. Just finished it.
Yeah.
Well, the reason why it worked there is that the evil protagonist, who's part of the team, has a certain set of values. He has a sense of honor. He has a sense of duty. He keeps his promise. Lovely. He's still scary and evil. She does a great job of keeping him evil. But as a reader, I know that I don't have to worry about him suddenly killing everybody else because she's set these guidelines within which he operates.
Yeah.
And so that was a great way. And like the Dr. Doom thing, he'd be operating within a certain set of guidelines. We know Dr. Doom is inherently honorable, if not kind of an evil jerk, and he'd keep his word. Mm-hmm. So we are able to read that entire story comfortably because we know that about the character.
We can trust something about
yes.
Well, yeah. Well, I wrote an X-Men novel where the X-Men team up with Dracula, the Marvel incarnation of Dracula, to fight the X-Men sorcerer demon villain Belasco. And I think you know part of what made that story interesting, which I hope it was, you know.
What's not interesting about that?
Right. Yeah. Well, first off, it's like the X-Men and Dracula hate each other. You know, I mean, they have a bad history, so it's interesting to see them trying to work together. And I think that Dracula is an inherently charismatic character, you know, so you're interested in seeing it. But I think, at least in that novel, there's the constant underlying feeling of, you know, I know he's going to turn on him. You know, when is this going to fall apart? When is this going to fall apart? And that, I think that that trope can work pretty well. Sometimes.
There's some of that tension in Alan Moore stuff, too, in you know, especially in something like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, where these people don't trust each other despite all of the powers that they each have and despite the fact that they may theoretically have some goal they're going towards, but there is some distrust about themselves, and they may have seen each other as antagonists at some point, you know, in their personal histories.
Another good example of sort of the Shades of Grey type of story, Guy Gavriel Kay wrote a book called The Lions of Alrasan. And it's kind of a loose retelling of the Spanish retaking Spain from the Moors. And the two main characters, eventually there's their conflict comes to a head. One is a Christian, one is kind of a Muslim character, and there's a battle at the end where it's clear that one of them is going to die, and you want them both to live. You want neither to die at the end, you know. So that, I mean, they're both protagonists, they're both antagonists. You know, this is a story about the conflict, and that's the backdrop to these characters that you come to love. So that's, I think, a really interesting thing to look at. And one other thing I'll say is that, this decision, like any decision in your story, is something that comes with a price to pay. You know, and I think it's good to just kind of think about, what those prices are and see if you're willing to pay them. So that's why it's good to just examine, who's done what already, see if that's something that you want to emulate and then you can tackle it.
Yeah, we have a hand there.
What do you guys feel about, you mentioned Darth Vader as a character who was kind of redeemed through the thing. Another kind of example when she was talking about an antagonist and a protagonist at the same time, I was thinking of Zuko from The Last Airbender, the cartoon.
What movie?
He was a protagonist when we're dealing with his family, but an antagonist when antagonist never dealing Bang until the end. I felt like I knew from like third episode that eventually he would join them. What do you guys think about that? The pitfalls if you want to have a redeemable evil character. Is there something, have you guys ever done that, or is it just too cliche to even try anymore? Or
well, Fallen Hero.
Sure, and remember that they're in service. I mean, as Mark said at the beginning, if you think of the antagonist as being broadly in service of your story, and more specifically in service of allowing your protagonist to grow, then there's no reason why, if the antagonist is redeemed at the end, that doesn't disrupt what you were doing with the antagonist before, right? The antagonist was still serving as a resisting force, as a force against which the protagonist defined themselves, as a way in which the protagonist measured themselves against the world, right? They do that because of the antagonist. So I think the key is to sort of do it naturally to the extent that you can, not to rush it to the extent you can, and to not do it if you feel that it's not necessary. I mean, the one objection I have to some modern writing is that it makes it seem as if everyone has to be redeemable. You know, the joke about, you know, Cthulhu just had a bad childhood. You know, it's like, that's absurd. It's absurd fundamentally because, you know, ultimately you're not, come on, this elder or god is not ultimately redeemable, right? So you don't have to do it. But if you want to do it, I think it's perfectly reasonable to, and sometimes it can be very powerful, especially when that redemption is itself a part of the protagonist's journey. So the reason it matters that Darth Vader is redeemed is not because we care all that much about Darth Vader, although we may or may not. What makes it important is that Luke needs to redeem him for him. And when Darth Vader comes over to the side, our reaction is, wow. We don't think, I love Darth Vader now. We think, Luke Skywalker really grew in that moment, and he needed to redeem.
That's exactly what happens in The Last Airbender, because the whole thing that happens with Zuko is the person who is trying to harm him the most is now someone he has to believe has changed. And it, because for the final battle, I'm not going to give it away, it's important for the final battle of this whole three-season series for Aang to learn about the possibility of redemption. And by accepting Zuko as having been redeemed, Aang grows as a character himself. Yeah. So that entire redemption process isn't about Zuko. It's about Aang.
Yeah.
Kind of connected to that, what about, I've noticed a lot of, you kind of mentioned not getting to the point where the antagonist becomes the protagonist. But I've noticed a lot of authors, they kind of have a character that keeps on coming back in a series for 4 or 5 books. Eventually, they start spinning off that character in a different set of books as the protagonist. What about that?
Well, that's normally that's not the antagonist unless you've redeemed him.
I'm thinking a lot about like the Drift series and Artemis.
Well, that's like Hollywood sequels. I mean, that's something that works.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, I think it's not, you know, I don't think there's anything intrinsically wrong with having a secondary character in your story and deciding, hey, you know, he's interesting enough and there's more to do with him and I can tell a story all about him, you know, and there's the, I don't see that, I think that's a fairly natural thing to do if you're working in an ongoing universe or something like that.
Sure.
I don't know if I've answered your question.
It's not about good and evil. I think that was brought up earlier that protagonist antagonist isn't good evil. It's person who is being prevented from achieving their goals, thing that is preventing them from achieving their goals. So your question is yes, you can absolutely do it, and the bad guy is the one trying to achieve a goal.
Sure.
I was just wondering if there's anything you like want to be careful of there.
Well, I think what I was saying before about, I mean, yeah, I think you want to be careful about keeping it from shifting so quickly on a repeated level that it becomes disruptive to the reader. So I think it's fine to shift a reader's perspective once, twice, a few times. I think if you do it 15, 20, 25, 30 times where he's good, he's bad, he's good, he's bad, he's good, he's bad, or he's, you know, he's a protagonist, an antagonist, right? You know, it becomes confusing and disruptive and ultimately off-putting. So when you're talking about like a spin-off series or something like that, I think people definitely have, you know, the brain space to be able to hold this concept of, I found this character really interesting, and oh, now I get to learn more about them. I have a character in the third sign called Blesian Drolnar, who's a merchant that kind of runs one of the cities in this country about which the book is set, sort of runs it behind the scenes. And I had a lot of readers who told me that they really found him fascinating. Now, Drolnar is kind of a cockroach, honestly. I mean, you know, he's not a good guy. He rules things, you know, he has this sort of sense of justification because he's smarter than everyone else and he's worked hard and so he deserves these things. But, you know, from an objective point of view, this is not an honorable person, nor is he a good person in any sense of the word. But people found him very interesting. Now, if I decided to start doing, and I have several chapters where he, of course, is the viewpoint character. If I started making, you know, this whole section of the book where it was like set of heroes, you know, doing whatever they're doing, and then Blesian Drolnar doing whatever he's doing, and then heroes, and then all of a sudden, like, you know, paragraph to paragraph, I'm alternating Drolnar heroes, Drolnar heroes. If I start doing that, then people are ultimately going to start feeling like I, as a reader, would feel like, wait a minute, what the hell's going on here? Like, where am I supposed to place my loyalties, at least temporarily? If, on the other hand, I then later on, after the series is finished, said, let me write a couple of short stories in which I just write about Drolnar, that's fine, because people aren't at that point going into the story thinking to themselves, they're going to see, oh, this is a point of view story about Drolnar, and I get to read about that. So I think the key is pacing and about how quickly and how much that you do it. And that's sort of a feel thing, I think, that you develop over the course of writing, you know, over time.
Yeah, if we swing back to George Martin, and if you haven't read The Song of Ice and Fire, do. In the first book, we come to see the Lannisters and Jaime, maybe particularly, as something that is as close to evil as we're going to get in those books. We really hate them. They do some really ruthless things. And then, I forget if it's book two or three, Jaime becomes a point of view character. And you know, he's still ruthless, but I come to understand him and I come to like him. Well, yeah, I mean, to each their own, but he's
hated him more.
At the very least, he's compelling, and maybe more compelling because I understand a little bit more about him. So, I'm in agreement that you can absolutely do that. Yeah.
As authors, if you're writing a story where you know you need multiple antagonists, how do you go about generating them? I mean, usually one or two probably come pretty easy, but when it comes down to you know you need others to flesh out other areas, how do you go about doing that? Is it a case of generating new characters and seeing what they do, just throwing them at the wall, or do you look at, like, something with, say, your hero and go, they have that flaw that needs to be worked on. What character can I create to do that?
Or history.
Well, me personally, my personal approach is that I spend a ton of time, much more time on the characters than I spend a lot of time on world building, building the magic, building the culture, building the history between them. And so that by the time that I get to the characters, and I understand a little bit about the structure of the societies that I'm working with, some of these things just naturally flow. Mm-hmm. So for me, the answer comes a little bit easily because I know so much about the world.
I think, you know, touching on what you had said, just that, you know, it's what is it you're trying to accomplish? What is it you're trying to do? However, I still like that somehow tying these antagonists together, because otherwise it's random encounters, yeah. And it feels like random encounters. It's like, oh, bandits on the road. It's like, so what? You know,
it's the wandering monster problem, right?
Exactly.
Like, you know, I rolled a five, damn it. You know,
it works. Encounter.
You know,
And the thing is that if there are bandits on the road, because the bad guy has sucked all of the military forces into a huge battle in the north, so now there's no one guarding the roads, and your character has to face bandits. Now that's kind of compelling. It's tied into the rest of the story. It's not the 36. You know, I mean, there's more to it.
I think also that, and this may be sort of a more general answer to your question, but I think what Brad says about knowing the world is important. I think if I have trouble developing, if I feel like something needs to be, some obstacle needs to flesh out a hero more and I'm not seeing it, it means I haven't really done the protagonist right. I haven't done the hero right. I don't understand the character well enough. I need to get a little bit more in the character's head sometimes. Sometimes I need to get a little bit more outside their head and sort of imagine what others think of that character. In some cases, I will sort of, if I really get stuck, it doesn't happen too often, but if it does, what I'll sometimes do is I'll write just a sort of separate paragraph, sort of of like the Flash thing you were talking about before, where I'll just talk about this character, pull them out of the story, and put them in some ridiculous situations, nothing to do with the story that I'm writing about, and kind of see as I'm writing it how they would interact, and kind of, you know, kick my brain into gear about what sort of develop an understanding more of that character. Then when I go back to the story, the main world in which that character is found, I can start imagining and understanding things a little bit differently, and it becomes easier to say, you know, in this situation, really, they need to be able to have, you know, this particular enemy that they would have to fight to get over this part of their personality, or they need to have this battle within themselves that the reader sees, and so this needs to be more of an internal conflict, or, you know, this they need to be sort of more affected by their environment, because to go back to Richard's point, they've always believed that they can conquer any environment, and maybe they need to learn that that's not always true, you know. So knowing, the more that you know about the world, or the protagonist or the person that you're involved with, will make it then easier, I think, to determine what your antagonist should be for them in that case, I found.
Well, the usual warning, please don't allow character development world building to get in the way of actually writing.
Oh, no. No, and please, the story.
World building and not have a chapter written yet. That's not going to...
Because you're not writing a source book. You're writing a novel.
Yeah.
And Brad doesn't write source books. Not for this.
Is there a hand back there in the corner?
Is it only coincidence we mentioned George Martin 2 seconds ago? Or is that just asking?
He kills off too many characters.
Yes, he does.
I think to the degree, again, I think it's about balance. I think that authors who are willing to kill off characters show you that if they do it for reasons. I actually saw, this is ironic, I saw George Martin on a panel with, I think, Steve Erickson and someone else at World Fantasy a couple of years ago, and he seemed bemused by why he was on this panel. And the panel was like, killing your characters, why do it, right? And Martin's like, I don't really know why I'm here. And everyone's kind of like, you know, and he was just like, you know, and his point was, when I killed them, I had to. Like, there was a reason that I was doing it. Now, some people can agree to disagree about whether, and I won't go into what I think about it, whether he does kill off too many or not. I think that when you kill off a character, you really need to be sure that it is critical to the story. The death needs to have meaning, even in its meaninglessness. If there is no meaning to the death, that has to serve a larger meaning to what this world has come to, you know? And we're all looking at, I can't believe they died for nothing. And that also colors our understanding of the world. You know, sorry, say again?
Killing Hedwig,
right. And by the way, I mean, there's an animal that dies in my book, and oh my God, did I take stuff for that? How could you kill? And I'm like, but it was this huge important point, and it like was mattered, and they were like, no, but you killed off that. This is the famous don't, you know, hurt babies or puppies in your story. You know, if you could kill off as many adults as you want. If you kill a puppy, oh my God, you know. But I think the key thing is to have it happen for a reason. Everything you write, every time, every part of your writing should be done for reasons. But I think that's my sort of take on it.
Well, one thing that I've run into is in the course of writing a couple stories, I've come to the realization that some sympathetic character has to take one for the team. And what I mean by that is that if you write these kind of adventure stories where it's like, you know, oh, we're up against this really, really powerful menace, you know, or that's what we're trying to cope with, and all your heroes, you know, go through encounter after encounter after encounter of what's supposed to be these, you know, menacing monsters or whatever, and nobody ever goes down, it's going to start to look stupid, or at least unconvincing, you know, and that can be a reason to kill somebody.
Sure.
We're out of time, so thank you all.
Thanks a lot.
If anybody has a ticket and did not give it to us, please bring it up here.